pals o' mine. It was brought to my attention that November 7th is Tongue Twister Day, so here are a couple for you to try. That bloke's back brake block is broke. The successful thistle sifter, in sifting a sieve full of unsifted thistles, stuck 3,000 thistles through the thick of his thumb. Toy boat remains an impossibility for me. I can't even make it past one. What caused it is a question most of us wonder whenever we hear about a plane crash on the news. Imagine hearing that friends have died in a plane crash. After the initial shock, grief settles in. And then that strong curiosity. Because you have assisted the military with helicopter and aircraft communication and navigation warfare equipment, your mind begins to consider the list of potential crash explanation scenarios. Later, your curiosity segues into historical crash puzzles. Next thing you know, you have become an aviation archaeologist or aircraft detective. That is David Trojan's backstory. David has a master's degree in professional aeronautics, an associate of science degree, and is a certified master electronics technician. Each aviation crash site has a story. So David's goal is to educate the public not only about aviation history, but to share each story. He has visited over 250 military aircraft crash sites, dating from 1918 to about 1960, in 12 different states, written over 30 published articles, has been featured on the Worldwide Armed Forces Radio and Television Network, given lectures to the Civil Air Patrol, FAA, Professional Pilots Association, American Aviation Historical Society, and university students concerning aviation archaeology and aviation history. He's currently assisting the Travis Air Force Base Heritage Center by researching and documenting major events and aircraft accidents during the 40s to the 60s. He recently investigated a P-5M Marlin flying boat crash site in the mountains about 40 miles east of San Diego. It occurred on January 1st, 1959, when the two pilots sacrificed their lives to allow the rest of the crew to parachute to safety. According to the accident report, the entire fuselage was very severely broken up and scattered, and the wreckage burned for 12 hours after the crash before it was finally extinguished. So these projects, you really have two stories that you're pursuing. You have the pilot and crew, if there was one, and the plane itself, because you're talking about many decades and different aerodynamics.
I investigate aircraft accidents, and I originally started looking at the engineering aspects because I have a background in engineering, aeronautical engineering, and I wanted to know, you know, hey, every plane kind of has its faults, and the design's constantly changed. And originally, I started, you know, finding out, oh, these always had bad engines, or this had a bad wing, or something. But the more I got into it, the more I realized it's the human element. It's that human aspect of, you know, these are young kids in their early 20s flying these high-powered planes, and aviation was all new, and it had all these accidents, unfortunately. And one of the things that bothered me was they blamed the pilot many times. And I was like, no, it's not the pilot's fault. Many times it's really the engineering of the plane, manufacturing defects, weather, navigation, early navigation was poor. There's all these other factors that weren't necessarily taken into account when they did initial investigations.
What was the name of the plane that they were using to fly mail, to deliver mail over really scary areas, you know, like the Tetons? And
The airmail routes, basically in the 1920s, 1930s, they typically used DH-4s, they called them. That was one of the main planes. But they also used Jennies. I know a lot about Jennies because I actually found some wreckage from a Jenny. But basically early biplanes, and the government tried to contract it out to civilian operators of these planes, and they just had a horrendous number of accidents, and they ended up, they couldn't do the job. So the military then had to step in, and then the military took over the airmail.
Weren't the planes made out of, was it aluminum? Something really lightweight?
Well, they were mostly wood and canvas at the time, in the 1920s and 30s.
So the wind, I mean, you're caught in a storm and you're screwed.
Yeah, with like a JN4 Jenny, the top speed was about 75 miles an hour. And if you had a headwind of 30 miles an hour, you know, you're only going to go 30 miles an hour, which is pretty slow. And I have some photographs where they, you know, that's when they climbed out on the wings and stuff, and they could actually stand there, and they were literally, the plane was barely doing 5 miles an hour sometimes, you know, so.
What were the planes that were going over the Himalaya that they were having problems? Because, again, it was the type of plane that they were flying, it's like in the 40s.
I think you're referring to, it was called Over the Hump. Those were mostly C-46 and C-47 cargo planes. They were supplying supply missions to China during the war, World War II. The statistics I have on that, there's still about 500 planes missing over the Himalayas to this day that they never found from World War II. And that's just an astounding number. But they lost a couple thousand planes in accidents, but I think almost 500 are still missing.
And yet, they continue to fly over there. The human spirit is very complicated. Now, what are some of the oldest planes that you've dug up or researched?
Well, I like to claim that I found some of the oldest plane wreckage that anybody has found. And that was, I was on a project in the state of Mississippi, and I was looking at aircraft accidents in central Mississippi, and I discovered that there was, on a map I saw that there was this place called Payne Field. And it was a World War I pilot training base. And I went out to the location, and it was really essentially had been abandoned since 1920, and nothing had changed since that time at the site. And I was able, took me a couple years of research, but I was able to get maps of the place and survey the place. And then I brought out a team of metal detector experts, and we scoured the site, and we found a number of JN4 Jenny aircraft parts left on the field from 1918.
Wow. Enough to put them together like a...
No, just enough to... I was able to identify the different fittings and parts. Like I found a oil cap and a buckle and some other things that were parts of the airplane, but nothing, you know, nothing substantial. But, you know, as they worked on the planes, they dropped parts, and that's how we found the parts.
Hmm.
Now, the oldest crash site that I think anybody has found, in my group that I know, is from the early 1920s. There was a plane crash, I think here in Southern California. A friend of mine found parts from an early 1920 crash site. The earliest known crash site I know that ever has been found, it was actually down in Antarctica. They found there was some plane from 1911 or 12 that they brought down there for an Antarctica expedition and wasn't successful, but the plane was wrecked in a storm or something and parts were left there, and those parts were found in the ice about 10-20 years ago, wreckage from the plane. From that's pretty old.
Were the corpses are probably in the ice, probably in...
Nobody died in that wreck.
Oh.
But they found parts of the plane still wrecked down there,
so they survived. Well, that's a happy ending.
Yeah.
So how do you come across these projects? Do you search them out? Do they come to you? Is it a little bit of both?
It's both. Many times I go searching for particular aircraft accidents, but sometimes when we're looking for one, many times we find another one. Amazingly, it occurs more often than not, especially in the state of Nevada. Just driving down the highway, we're going to another site, and we're looking out into the desert up in the hills, and we see a little spot of glitter up on the side of the hill, and we go, you know, what is that shiny thing up there? And we stopped the car, and we hiked out. It turned out to be just over a mile, and it was a nose cone from an F-4 Phantom fighter jet. And we go, wow, well, let's start looking around. And so we start looking around, and here's the radar, and here's the front of the plane, and then here's the engines and the wings. And we found this debris trail that went for several miles out in the desert, and it was from a fighter jet. And it's not one we were looking for, but we found it. It turned out we found, but the debris trail kept going and going, and it turned out there was a second debris trail connected to the first, and it turned out it was a mid-air collision between two fighter jets, and they had both came down in this one area. And it took about almost 2 years of going back to the site, resurveying different areas of it, and looking for the identification marks to figure out which plane it was. And from our records, we knew that there was approximately 30 F-4 Phantoms were lost in the state of Nevada. But we're like, well, which one of the 30 is this? And after about 2 years, I finally found the part of the vertical tip of the tail with had specific paint markings on it. I was able to identify the squadron and found some other markings in the debris, and that led to positive identification that it was a wreck from 1979. And it was really just a quest of, you know, trying to identify which plane it was.
So you're more than an archaeologist, you're a detective.
Yeah, in fact, I like to say I'm more like an air crash detective.
Yeah.
But I do more than just air crashes. I do abandoned airfields, as example was the one in Mississippi, finding this old World War I training field that was forgotten. I initially started doing airfields, abandoned airfields in Hawaii that were used during World War II. And that's how I got a master's project started on that. But I also do lost and abandoned airplanes. People said, oh, I own this plane and what happened to it, you know? And so I can look through the FAA records and say, oh, now so it got scrapped or so-and-so owns it, you know?
But not all planes, I would imagine, have a paper trail though, do they?
No. And sometimes it's really complicated. Some of the planes at the Travis Air Museum, for example, I've been researching their history, and they're currently painted a certain way with a certain serial number, but in actuality, the serial number that's painted on the plane is not the true serial number. I have to look for the data plates that are inside the plane that have manufacturer's numbers that I can trace to the true serial number to find out the true identity of the plane. Because as planes changed hands through the museum system, they were painted different ways and the true identity gets lost.
Why would museums do that?
It's common, actually, in air museums to do that because they paint them kind of at the whim of the volunteers or the museum. You'll see a lot of B-25s are all painted to be a Doolittle B-25, for example, because that's the most famous B-25. And so there's several Mustangs that are all named the same Mustang because that was the most famous P-51 Mustang. So there's several planes like that.
That's a disservice to visitors, though. Because they walk away thinking that they have visited Doolittles when it is a fake.
Right.
It's a phony. And there's nothing wrong with having an exact type of plane that he flew. There's no reason behind that. That's just silly pride and control issues, and that annoys the hell out of me.
But also, in addition to, you know, airfields and crash sites, I've done aircraft dump sites where a number of air bases that when they closed, they just took a bunch of plane parts and threw them in a hole and buried them. And we come along, you know, 60 years later and say, hey, where's that dump site at? Let's go dig it up and find all these airplane parts. And some of the parts are rare and historically significant, and they can go in museums.
Are they salvaged for use, though, also? Because there are all these collectors now, they could probably use them without having to recreate them from scratch.
I have yet to salvage for use, but I've salvaged for museums. That's what I've done. I know there's a number of other people that look to salvage for use.
I guess you really want a brand new part if you're going to fly a plane. But yes. I was thinking that if you're trying to duplicate a part, maybe you don't have a template for it to create. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, and at a plane crash site where the plane is broken apart and corroded and been, you know, exposed to the weather for 50, 60 years, most of those parts really aren't usable. But they're still important because they can be used as templates in the reconstruction of a replica airplane.
Right.
So they're still very significant and important that way.
Many airfields are named after individuals, and so you have an additional story beyond that. Like the one here in Sacramento area, Travis. That's an unsolved mystery.
Yes, Travis, in fact, I just got a call recently, how did Travis get his name? Well, originally it was called Fairfield Sassoon Army Airfield.
That's a long one.
Yes, and it was named that way because it was the location. And General Travis was on a B-29 taking off in August 5th, 1950 on the way to the Korean War, and he crashed in a B-29. The plane crashed on the base. He was a real famous and interesting guy. He was a general in World War II, flew on many bombing missions over Germany with the 8th Air Force. So he was kind of a hero of World War II. And when he died in 1950, they decided to rename the base after him.
Now, what about Payne? You mentioned a Payne landing field. Who was Payne?
Payne Field in Mississippi. Payne was a, I can't think of his first name. He was a pilot in World War I, and he died in an aircraft accident. He was actually, a fellow pilot had crashed, and he was taking off to go find out where his buddy had crashed at, and he ended up crashing.
Bummer.
And was killed. And so it's fairly common that they named airfields after aviators that died in airplane accidents.
Now, because of your background, you obviously are an expert in not only flight navigation, but also communication. But I'm guessing that throwing in that mix when you're detecting or digging, that you're throwing in a bit of intuition in the mix as well, kind of putting yourself in their shoes. And, you know, if you don't have any record of the pilot or crew's statements of what occurred, that you're just kind of guessing what may have, like historical weather data, maybe? Do you use some of that?
Yeah, a couple things I'll say is I generally don't dig at a crash site. We generally just survey what's on the surface.
Is that out of respect for the deceased, or is it just...
Yeah, mostly. I just don't want to... I'm almost afraid to discover sometimes what's buried there, and I just want to see what's on the surface. And there's usually plenty to see on the surface. And it's really... The main thing we try to do is locate, you know, the main site, and you can do that by this just by looking at the surface. You don't have to dig down to find the stuff. As far as the investigating the site, there's several records associated with any aircraft accident. There's nothing I'll say is I only out of over 250 sites, I only do military aircraft accidents. I've done one civilian plane accident and one commercial jet accident, but that's out of over 250 sites. So with the military sites, so I have the official military accident report. That gives us a lot of information to go on. And then also research the newspaper reports. There's usually some kind of newspaper reporting associated with it. And the official accident reports do have weather data in them. So it can give you a lot of information. But another thing I like about aviation archaeology, though, is I don't know everything about every airplane. There's just too many. But there's other people out there that I can turn to that are experts on particular types of airplanes. So when I have questions and say, hey, did these planes have, you know, bad engines or, you know, bad landing gear or something, they can tell me that. Sub-expertise is avionics or radio equipment. And there's been a couple sites where we literally found just a fragment of a radio, and I was able to say, oh, this particular type is only used on a particular type of airplane, and we're able to narrow it down to say, oh, this crash site is this particular airplane. It was the one site I can think of is it was an SBD Navy dive bomber from World War II, and we found some radio equipment, and they only used a particular radio in it, and I was able to say, yeah, this is what this is.
Well, what about areas, say, like Death Valley, where maybe the sands of time have covered a great deal of the wreckage?
Actually, in Death Valley, there's several crash sites. There's a midair between two B-24s, and the wreckage is still right there on the surface. In fact, one of the propellers is sticking up out of the ground out in the middle of Death Valley. I've never been there, but I've known some friends of mine have been there, and I've seen pictures of it.
Well, I guess if you can still see wagon tracks, you can still see a propeller sticking out.
I initially started aviation archaeology back in the early 90s in Hawaii. At the time, I used to go hiking a lot up in the mountains. And I found some airplane wreckage. And I started asking around, hey, what is this? And of course, everybody in Hawaii says, oh, it's a Japanese Zero. And I was like, no, it's not a Japanese Zero, because I can tell it's got English writing in the wreckage.
Big tell.
And it took me about 2 years to figure out that it was a B-24 bomber and that it had crashed going on a flight to Australia. It got me started just asking the questions about, what is this? How did it crash? You know, who was aboard it? It's asking the questions and then doing the research and then going back to the sites many times and, you know, looking at different things and figuring it out.
Now, you've probably had an opportunity to speak with some of the pilots that flew some of those planes.
Yes. I recently talked to a B-24 pilot from World War II. I asked him, hey, did you like this plane? You know, do you like the B-24? What is it compared to the B-17? And he gave me this great answer to say, I'd rather fly in a B-24 because it's easier to fly and easier to land. But if I'm going into combat, I'd rather be in a B-17 because they can take the battle damage better. And I go, that's exactly what I read. And you confirmed what my suspicion was.
Besides the ghost stories, those that supposedly hang around crash sites, there are those that actually survived the crashes. And so do you have any stories of those that were able to live a full life and kind of where their lives went from there?
Well, the one story that comes to mind is Chuck Yeager. Everybody's heard of Chuck Yeager, and everybody thinks, oh, he's the greatest pilot. But we have accident reports on file that he had 12 major accidents during his Air Force career, and a lot of people don't realize that.
That's like Babe Ruth and all his strikeouts.
Right. He's remembered for, you know, the things he did, not all the planes he wrecked. Even Jimmy Doolittle, I researched him recently, and I think I have 6 accident reports on file for him. And it's interesting reading those reports to say, oh, you know, they admit in the reports many times that they made mistakes, and that's why the plane crashed, but they were lucky to survive. And they learned from that experience, and what they learned really shaped the way that person became. You know, they learned from that mistake. Lindbergh's another great example that he investigated one of his accidents, and he actually crashed in Mississippi in the early 1920s before he crossed the Atlantic, and he crashed because he got lost. And he learned from that accident to make sure he's got a compass, and he learned to pay more attention to his navigation, and that really served him well later when he went to cross the Atlantic. So he learned from those mistakes.
Now, you've got a serious background in navigation, so that gives you maybe more of an insider's viewpoint than maybe the average aviation detective, knowing what panels, what instruments maybe can go off track faster than others for certain types of planes.
I have a background in radios and radar and navigation, and I even did some electronic warfare stuff during my military service, and it gives me a really good technical background, but I'm real detail-oriented. That's what it really gave me. And in an aircraft accident investigation, you have to be detail-oriented to pick up on these little facts and figures that are in the reports. It always fascinates me is, you know, how do they figure out the cause of some of these accidents when the plane is all smashed up? But they do, and it's because of paying attention to these little details.
Forensics of sorts, I guess.
Yes, that's part of it.
Now, there are a lot of pieces of crash sites even spread out, Auburn area and out here, and it's easy for people that want to take souvenirs. But as people were learning slowly that the reason the Titanic has not been pulled up and it hasn't been salvaged is because it is respect for the site. There is a sacred aspect to it. So how do you determine what to leave there and what to, say, donate to a museum?
Well, primarily, we research, we locate the sites, and we document it by just photographing what's there at the site. And, you know, most of the debris is just, you know, metal fragments. And if I try to pick up all the metal fragments I ever found, you know, I'd have to have truckloads. But, you know, it's not valuable. Although back in the 50s, many of the plane crash sites were salvaged for their aluminum, and they were melted down and sold for just the aluminum scrap value. But as far as the wreckage is concerned, if you find a crash site, the Air Force has really abandoned any of the pieces. Once they complete their investigation, and they don't claim any more ownership to the site or debris. Now, if it's on private property, then it's the landowner where the plane crashed. It becomes their property. Unless there's some hazardous material there that the Air Force needs to come and clean up, like an unexploded bomb or something, it becomes the property owner. Now, if the plane is on a federal property, it becomes like if it's a Forest Service or Bureau of Land Management jurisdiction. Their only concern is if it's historic enough, and it's only if it's over 50 years, it's considered the Antiquities Act, and they have to mitigate some of the wreckage to say, well, is this historic wreckage or is it just common wreckage? And, you know, most of the time it's pretty common wreckage. So unless it's a rare airplane or someone famous was involved in the accident, then it's not that historic enough to preserve. If I find something historic, I like to, you know, contact the local museum and say, hey, this is happened in your backyard. This is kind of under your jurisdiction. Are you interested in having something recovered for your museum collection? And many times they do. Currently at the Travis Air Force Base Museum, I have a big display on one of the walls about aviation archaeology, and it includes a number of artifacts that were collected at some crash sites. In the display, there's a case full of parts of two Corsairs that crashed at Mount Tamalpais. That was a mid-air collision, and luckily the pilots bailed out, so they were not fatal. And what I like about Mount Tamalpais is there's actually a trail that you can go on. It's called Plane Crash Trail. And you can hike up, and here's an engine from one of the Corsairs on the trail. A number of pieces from the Corsair were collected by souvenir hunters. And it turns out if it's Navy wreckage, the Navy claims ownership over all those parts for forever. So it's totally different than the Air Force policy. So the parts were collected by souvenir hunters. The park ranger at Mount Tamalpais said, hey, you know, you got to return these parts because they're Navy property, and people turned in some of the parts, and they were collected and they were brought, ended up in the Hamilton Field Museum. And right now I have some of those parts on loan to the Travis Air Museum. That's how I got them.
So tell me about some of the projects you're working on now.
Well, my holy grail is to find a Japanese plane crash from December 7th, 1941 in Hawaii. The story is that 29 Japanese planes were shot down during the attack, and it turns out we only know where about 13 of them landed.
Really?
So more than half of them, we don't know where they are. Of course, most of those were landed in the water, offshore, going back to the carrier and stuff like that. But the exact location where some of those planes were shot down was lost to history. The panic, literally, that was going on the night of December 7th, there was a failure to really record where a lot of these planes crashed and what happened to them. And some of the records were lost, and some records were never made. So there's several really interesting cases that I'm involved with in Hawaii. It's trying to research using eyewitness accounts. You know, where did this plane crash? You know, what happened to the wreckage? What happened to the Japanese crewmen? There's been a recent resurgence by the Japanese government to account for their airmen.
That's going to be my next question.
Just as we are accounting for our lost airmen in Vietnam,
right?
They want to account for their lost airmen from December 7th in Hawaii. And it turns out in several cases in Hawaii, the Japanese airmen were buried right next to their plane crashes in the ground. And the graves were never marked. It was never recorded. Hmm. And they're still there to this day. And there's still a possibility that we could locate those crash sites and recover the remains from the Japanese.
You were stationed in Hawaii.
Yes, I spent about 25 years there. And that's when I was hiking. I was actually hiking looking for these Japanese planes, but I was finding all these American planes. My first plane site I found was turned out to be a B-24. Spent a couple years trying to identify it. And then I met a guy in Hawaii, and he says, oh, that B-24 is nothing. You should see the other 12 that are up on the ridge. I was like, what? And I couldn't believe it. And he says, oh, and then there's all these others. And it turns out we have a list now. There's about 200 plane crash sites on Oahu. But they're all up in the mountains, up in the jungle, in all these isolated areas. You know, getting to them is really difficult. I went to about 12 of them, different types of aircraft on Oahu. But there's several hundred were lost in the Hawaiian Islands, mostly offshore, but some landed on the island. And finding them and investigating the stories behind them is what kept me going. At the time, I was going to college, and I was like, well, what better thing to write about is write about these, finding these sites, and why did they crash, and the human factors involved in the accidents and the mechanical problems and the navigation and all this. So that's how I really got in depth into investigation.
How many were shot down and how many were just plane or pilot error, like percentage-wise, do you know, generally?
For Hawaii?
Yeah.
Well, they were mostly just accidents. But some statistics I want to talk about is during the World War II period alone, between December 1941 and September 1945, we have on record 53,000 aircraft accident reports in the continental United States.
Wow.
And out of the 53,000, there's over 15,000 airmen were killed in those accidents. And that's more deaths than the airmen that were lost in the 8th Air Force flying bombing missions in Germany. And so this is a huge number of accidents and a huge number of loss of life, and they're really forgotten. And just because their deaths were less glamorous than combat deaths, they still need to be remembered and honored and investigated, and the family members still remember them. And when I've contacted family members and say, hey, do you remember we've located your uncle's crash site and there's still wreckage there and artifacts there, and wow, we always wanted to know what happened to our uncle. You know, we were told that he died in a plane crash. That's all they're told. And when I go and say, hey, here's the accident report, this is what really happened. He was screwing off and screwed up, or hey, the plane was a defective plane and the plane crashed because it wasn't even his fault.
How cool that you can do that for families.
And one of the projects I'm going on right now is it's a B-47 bomber that crashed in northern Nevada, and it crashed in 1957. One of the crew members had a son that was only a couple years old at the time. He lost his father, so he never knew his father. We're making arrangements now to bring the son to the crash site next spring, and we're going to put a memorial up at the crash site, and there's still lots of debris at the crash site. The most famous case I have to tell you about is a guy named Gerard Volpe. Some people might know him from Consolidated Volpe Aircraft Company. Well, Mr. Volpe was an aircraft designer back in the 30s. And he was world famous. He designed planes for Amelia Earhart, Charles Lindbergh. He was just ahead of his time in the mid-1930s. And unfortunately, he was selling contracts to the government in Washington and was flying back home to California. They crashed in the mountains in Arizona, him and his wife. And they were killed in it was a Denson-Reliant airplane. It's the only civilian airplane accident that I ever investigated. But this occurred in 1938. And as I investigated, I came across a newspaper article that said that, oh, they had a six-month-old child that was orphaned in the accident. And I thought, wow, 6 months old. And this was in 2007, and that would make him about, 70 years old. I thought, well, this guy could still be alive. And I did an internet search, and I found the guy on the internet. He lives up in Washington, and I got his phone number. I called him up. I said, are you Peter Volpe, the son of Gerard Volpe? And he says, yes. I said, did you have a father that died in a plane crash? And he says, yes. I said, well, I found your father's plane crash site in the mountains of Arizona. And he says, I've been looking for that for my whole life, and I've always wanted to go there. So I made arrangements. He came from Washington State down to Arizona, and we went up into the mountains of Arizona, and I took him to his parents' crash site. It turned out his parents' remains were cremated after the accidents, so he had no grave to go to, and he had no real mementos of anything that they owned from his parents. And he never knew his parents. And we were able to find some artifacts, some belongings from his parents, and we left a nice memorial at the site, and it said it brought the guy closure after 70 years. He finally got closure for visiting his parents' site.
You're a hero.
Now, there are probably other people out there that are wondering, do you have services that they could hire you to locate or try to track down crashes?
Well, I'm happy to help if I can. Accident reports are available. A friend of mine runs a website where you can get copies of the accident reports, which is Aviation Archaeological Investigation and Research, AAIR. They can also be obtained through the Air Force, but it usually takes a longer time. But you can get them for free, but it takes longer time and you get less quality. So that's the first step, really, is getting a copy of the accident report. And you'll learn a lot. Many times the accident reports will have eyewitness statements, they'll have statements from the pilots, and so you can get the first-hand account. Because again, the families were never told what happened. And so this is the first time that, wow, this is what really happened to this. It's definitely part of family history that people want to know.
Tell me about a project that just maybe brought out the little kid in you. Maybe a story you read when you were a child, or some legend that somehow you had come across.
The Air Force Thunderbird flight demonstration team. Everybody's seen them. They're famous, world famous. I was living in Arizona at the time. I found the story about, hey, Thunderbirds actually have a long history of accidents. And the first fatal Thunderbird accident occurred in 1954. And it occurred in the desert in Arizona. So I got interested in this story. I was like, well, we should try and find this site and see if there's anything there. And it was really difficult because the accident reports, they really general location. They'll say, you know, 5 miles from Luke Air Force Base or something. It's just a general location. They never give you any specifics. And so we just had a general location, and we put a team together, I think of about a dozen people, and we lined up in the desert and just started to walk out in the desert looking for this, because we knew that you could literally could be within a couple feet of some of these micro sites, we call them, and you could miss it. So you got to really know what you're kind of looking for. And we just lined up, walked out in the desert, and sure enough, we started finding little turbine blades. And the turbine blades led to the crash site of the first fatal Thunderbird accident in 1954. And the accident was really important because it led, the cause of the accident was the controls were jammed, and in the wreckage, they found screwdrivers. And it turned out the most likely cause of the accident was a tool got jammed in the controls and the pilot was unable to pull out of a dive. And because of that accident, though, they started the program of tool control and this other thing called FOD control, which is foreign object damage. And this was early jets. They never had these problems with propeller planes. It was only during the jet age that they started having these problems. But because this one accident started these programs that they still use today, they still have the tool control program where you check out a tool and then you have to check it back in and you have to, you know, pick up and account for all your nuts and bolts and washers, FOD control, to prevent accidents from occurring again. And that's one of the things I like to do is you can find out, you know, where it crashed and you can find out sometimes why it crashed. But I want to know too is what changed as a result of the accident? What was learned from this accident? Sometimes it's in the reports and you can find out, oh, wow, they made this change to the design of the plane. They made a change to the programs of maintaining the planes, a training of the pilots, whatever. So there's recommendations in the reports. And then I want to know, hey, did they really implement those recommendations? It's really kind of closes then the story of that particular accident. But sometimes, though, there was another case I was involved in. It was a P-3 Orion Navy patrol plane. It crashed in Nevada in 1971. And the Navy said they basically closed out the report and said, it was hit by lightning, end of story, and it crashed. Well, I read the report and go, you know, it doesn't sound like a lightning strike to me because planes get hit by lightning all the time and they don't crash. So why did this one particular plane crash? Well, buried in the report was, it turned out, the Lockheed Company did an analysis of the wreckage months after the Navy had basically closed out their portion of the report. And they said, no, it was not lightning. There was a wing failure. So then I was like, well, why is there a wing failure? And then Lockheed said, well, we don't know why the wing failed. And so then I looked at the report more in depth, and there was a weather report in there. And in the weather report, it said, oh, there was thunderstorms. It was in August in the desert. So there's all these thermal updrafts and downdrafts. And it turned out the most likely cause was wind shear. And in 1971, they didn't know what wind shear was. But I'm able to go back in time with all this benefit of this new knowledge of weather forecasting and all this knowledge of wind shear now and say, hey, the conditions were right at that time in 71 for wind shear, and that's most likely the cause of this accident. And it wasn't what the Navy said. It wasn't what Lockheed said. It was a weather. And I wrote a report about that, and I sent that out. I was asked by family members to reinvestigate that case because they were not satisfied either by the report. And I was able to then give the family some closure to say, hey, this
is... You were correct. It was something else.
It was something else.
So here's the biggest question of this interview. How do you make the perfect paper airplane? If you're interested in learning more about this work, there are two websites worth checking out. Wreckchasing.com, WreckChasing.com, which offers some of David's articles on the message board, and aviationarchaeology.com, where you can order accident reports. Also, David is open to email questions at davidtrojan@earthlink.net. In my continuing celebration of national parks, I'm heading over to Washita Battlefield National Historic Site, where Lieutenant Colonel George A. Custer led the 7th U.S. Cavalry on a surprise Dawn attack against the southern Cheyenne village of Peace Chief Black Kettle on November 27, 1868. Custer's orders were to go down south till he came to the Washita River and follow it down until he came across the hostiles. He was to shoot and hang all the warriors, capture all the women and children, and destroy the camp and horses. Custer's general plan was to employ the hours between the time he got there and daylight to completely surround the village, and at daybreak, or as soon as it was barely light enough for the purpose, to attack the Indians from all sides. This tactic was the U.S. Army mainstay during the Indian Wars, both before and after Washita. Troops in loose order formation would surround a village whose occupants were asleep, and then they would attack from all sides at the same time, preferably at dawn, killing and wounding the residents, capturing the ponies, and destroying their property. Custer had a regimental band playing Gary Owen during the attack, but it was so cold, the instruments froze up and they had to stop halfway through. Later in the day, when the command left the village area, the band played I Will Be Glad to Get Out of the Wilderness. According to Magpie, the Cheyenne women pulled both Black Kettle and his wife's body from the river and carried them up the pony trail north of the river to a sandy knoll. There they debated where to bury them. To this day, no one actually knows where the chief is buried. Custer lost 22 men in the fighting, 2 officers and 20 enlisted. His first casualty was Captain Lewis Hamilton, grandson of Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury of the United States. Custer claimed to have killed 103 and later 140, but according to the Cheyenne and Arapaho nations, there were 60. 53 women and children were captured by Custer and first taken to Camp Supply, then Fort Hays, Kansas, where they were released in July 1869 to the Anadarko Indian Agency, Indian Territory. Moving behind was a 14-year-old Cheyenne girl living with her aunt, Cornstalk Woman. They hid in a batch of tall red grass growing on a hillside southwest of the encampment, but were spotted by a passing soldier. "He stopped his horse and stared at us," said Moving Behind. "He did not say a word, and we wondered what would happen. But he left, and no one showed up after that." Some years later, George Bent introduced the two women to the soldier, a tall man with a brown mustache and blue eyes. According to Cheyenne oral tradition, when Custer caught up with the Cheyenne at Sweetwater, there was a meeting in Medicine Arrow's lodge. Custer was asked to smoke a pipe, and it went around the lodge. When it came back around, the chief dumped the ashes on Custer's boots, telling him that if Custer ever lied to the Cheyenne or attack the Cheyenne, he and his men would be killed. Custer left the Cheyenne alone for 7.5 years, until June 1876 at Little Bighorn. The Cheyenne have a long memory. The Dawes Act of 1889 would end the Cheyenne and Arapaho Reservation. The act forced the individual Indians onto 160 acres and ended the communal land ownership of the reservation. The government bought 3.5 million acres from the Indians at 10 cents an acre. Then they gave the Indians a choice where they wanted to live. The Cheyenne and Arapaho chose the river bottom land along the Canadian River between Canton and El Reno and the Washita River between Hammond and Clinton. The land was open on April 19, 1892, to 30,000 homesteaders. Oklahoma State's wildflower, Firewheel, can be found while walking the trail at the battlefield. According to legend, the Great Spirit created the Indian blanket to honor an Indian artisan. Do you know about Cowbird? The website offers what it calls a human library, where people share short stories of life experiences, in story or poem form with accompanying photos, audio, or video. Plus, when you subscribe, you'll receive a Cowbird story in your email each day. which is a little loverly. I'm a contributor, so if you'd like to know a little bit more about me, I have a few stories there, which I will be adding to periodically. Again, that's calbird.com. Do something different. Whistle a happy tune.